getting the words out before I say them to security because I still can't picture myself saying them. I found my husband's picture. I don't know how I'll do it without breaking down. I walk down the long hall to my vault, our locked suite of cubicles and offices set behind a heavy vault door, like they all are. Another badge, another code. I walk past Patricia, the secretary, and past the offices of the managers, through the rows of cubicles back to the one I call my own. The one I tried so hard to make like home. The crayon drawings, pictures of my kids, of Matt. My life hung with pushpins. I log on, another set of passwords, and start brewing a pot of coffee while I wait for system authentication. The computer's ready before the coffee. I open Athena. More passwords. Then I pour coffee into my mom mug, the one that Matt gave me last Mother's Day. The one with the picture of our kids. It's one of those rare ones where all four of them are looking at the camera, three of them actually smiling. Took us 10 minutes to get that shot. Me making ridiculous noises and Matt jumping up and down and waving his arms behind me. Both of us looking like lunatics, I'm sure. Athena loads, and I click through the warning screens, the ones I disregarded yesterday by telling Matt. His words run through my head unbidden. I'll never tell, I swear. And he won't, will he? More of his words run through my head. I'm loyal to you. I believe that. I do. I'm back in Yuri's computer. Same as yesterday. Same blue background, same bubbles, same icons lined up in four rows. My gaze settles on the last one. Friends. The vault is quiet. I glance around and no one's nearby. I double-click and the folder opens to the list of five images. I click open the first. Same guy with the round glasses. Then the second, the redhead. My eyes linger on the next, the third, the one with Matt's picture. But I don't open it. Can't. I skip to the next, the fourth. A woman with pale skin and wispy blonde hair. The fifth, a young guy with spiky hair. I close it. Close the whole folder and stare at the screen, the blue bubbles, the icon with the folder. Friends. All sleepers. How is this possible? My gaze drifts to the top of the screen, right side. Two buttons. Active, passive. There's highlighting around passive. The only mode the analysts are permitted to use, the one that creates a mirror image of the target's screen, doesn't allow manipulation. But it's the active button that draws my eyes, holds them in place. I hear something behind me. I turn and see Peter standing there. I go shaky. Even though there's no way he saw where my eyes landed, where my attention was focused, no way he knows the thoughts that are running through my head. He glances at my screen, and I feel a rush of adrenaline. The folder's right there. But it's just a folder, and it was just a glance. His eyes are back on me. "How's your little girl?" he asks. "Fever, but otherwise okay." I try to keep my voice as even as possible. "Matt's home with her today." "Matt." I swallow down the lump in my throat. "Tina came by yesterday," he says. "She wants to see you." "Why?" I say quickly, too quickly. Tina's the head of the counterintelligence center. Fierce, no nonsense. Tough as nails, Tina. There's a flash of confusion on Peter's face. "She knows we're in the laptop, wants to know what we've found." "But I haven't had time." "I told her that, don't worry. I pushed the meeting to tomorrow morning. She just wants to know if there's anything that looks promising." "But it's just 10 minutes. Spend today digging around, I'm sure you'll come up with something." "Like pictures of five sleepers? one of whom is my husband. Okay. He hesitates. Want a hand? I can take a look, too. No, I say, again, too quickly, too forcefully. No, don't worry about it. You've got a lot on your plate. I'll come up with something for her. Peter nods, but there's an odd expression on his face. Uncertain, he hesitates. Are you okay, Vivian? I blink at him, and I know what I have to say. I have to do this. I don't have a choice. I need to talk with you about something. In private. There's a sick feeling in my stomach as I say it, but I have to get it over with before I lose my nerve. Give me 10 minutes. I'll ping you when I'm ready. I nod and watch as he walks away, back toward his office. I just set this in motion. 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, my world will change. Everything will be different. Life as I know it will be over. I turn back to the screen, the folder. Friends. And then I look away because I have to. Over to my far wall, past the pictures of my family, because I can't look at them right now or I might break down. My gaze settles on a little chart, something that's been there for years, ignored. A handout from a training course on analytic rigor. I scan it now for the first time in ages, something to take my mind off reality. Consider second and third order implications. Think about unintended consequences. His words this morning in the driveway run through my head. Money'll be tight. We'll lose his salary. That much I've already considered. I'll have to pull the youngest 3 out of school for sure, probably hire a nanny, someone cut rate. And I'll have to swallow my fear of a stranger watching my kids, driving them around. For the first time, though, it dawns on me that I'll lose my job, too. There's no way Tina would agree to keep me on, to let me keep my security clearance when I was married to a Russian spy. It's one thing to lose Matt's salary. How will we survive if we lose mine, too? Oh, God. We'll lose my health insurance. Caleb. How is Caleb possibly going to get the care he needs? I picture Matt breaking down. What's this going to do to the kids? Suddenly the future appears before my eyes, the media spectacle that this is sure to become. My kids, no father, no money, ripped from everything they know. The notoriety that'll always follow them, the shame, the suspicion, because after all, they're his flesh and blood, sons and daughter of a traitor. I'm frozen in fear. None of this should have happened. If I hadn't stumbled upon the photo, hadn't come up with that damn algorithm, fought my way into Yuri's laptop, I wouldn't know about Matt. No one would. His words ring in my head, if only you weren't so good at your job. My eyes shift back to the buttons at the top of the screen, active, passive. I can't do this, can I? But I'm moving the cursor there anyway until the arrow's hovering over active. I click, and the borders of the screen change from red to green. Guilt threatens to overwhelm me. I think of my first day on the job, raising my right hand, taking the oath, support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Matt's not an enemy, though. He's not a bad guy. He's a good person, a decent person, someone who was taken advantage of as a kid, trapped in circumstances beyond his control. He hasn't done anything wrong, brought any harm to our country. He wouldn't. I know he wouldn't. I move the cursor to the folder. I right-click. Guide the arrow down to the command, delete. And then I hover there, my hand trembling. Time. I just need more time. Time to think. Time to figure things out. Time to come up with a solution. There has to be a solution, a way out of this, a way to go back to the way things were before. I close my eyes, and I'm at the altar with Matt, looking into his eyes, saying my vows, in good times and in bad. I promised to be true to him all the days of my life. And then I hear his voice last night. I'll never tell, Viv, I swear. I'd never do that to you. He wouldn't, would he? And here I am, about to do exactly that to him. Images of our kids run through my mind, each of their faces so innocent, so happy. This would destroy them. And then another memory from our wedding day, our first dance, the words Matt whispered in my ear, the ones that have never made sense for all these years. There's a sudden clarity to them now. I open my eyes and they instantly find the word delete. Highlighted, the cursor still hovering over it. More words float through my head, and I don't even know if they're his or mine or if it matters. I just wish none of this had happened. I wish I could make it disappear. And then I click. Chapter 6. The folder is gone. I hold my breath and watch the screen, waiting for something else to happen. But it doesn't. The folder just vanished, like none of this ever happened. Exactly what I wanted, right? My breathing starts again, quick little bursts of air. I guide the cursor up to the button at the top of the screen. Passive. I click and the border turns red. And the folder's still gone. I continue to stare at the place where it should be, where it just was. Same blue bubbles in the background, one less icon in the last row. I hear a phone ring a few rows away, typing from nearby keyboards, the strains of an anchor on a 24-hour news channel, one of the televisions suspended from the ceiling. Oh, God, what did I just do? Panic courses through me. I deleted files from a target's computer. Switching to active mode, stepping into operational territory, that alone would be enough to get me fired. What was I thinking? My gaze drifts up to the top left corner, the familiar icon, the recycle symbol. It's in that bin, isn't it? I didn't get rid of it, not all the way. I double-click the icon, and there it is. Friends. The file. I look at the buttons again. Active, passive. I could restore it, pretend none of this ever happened. Or I could delete it altogether, follow through with what I started. Either way, I need to do something. It can't just sit there. Delete it altogether. That's what I want to do, what I need to do. There's a reason I did it in the first place, protecting Matt, my family. I glance behind me. No one there. Then I click the active button, move the cursor, click delete, switch back to passive mode an instant later. Gone. I stare at the empty bin and rack my brain, trying to remember what I know about deleting files. It's still there, somewhere. Data recovery software could retrieve it. I'll need something to overwrite it. Something like... There's a ding and a small white box pops up in the center of my screen. I seize with fear. This is it. Some sign that I've been caught, discovered. But it's Peter's face in the little box. Words he typed. Come on over. I go weak. It's just Peter. I forgot I even asked to meet with him. I close out the box and lock my computer, my hands shaking. Then I walk toward his office. What am I going to say? I replay the last conversation in my mind. I need to talk with you about something in private. Oh, this is bad. What on earth am I going to say? His door is open a crack. I see him at his computer, his back to me. I give a quick rap on the door, and he swivels his chair around to face me. Come on in. I push the door open. His office is tiny, all of them are. Just his desk, modular and gray like mine, and a small round table, overloaded with stacks of papers. I sit in the chair beside it. He crosses his legs at the ankles, peers at me over the top of his glasses. I can tell he's waiting for me to speak. My mouth feels dry. Shouldn't I have figured out what I was going to say before I came in here? I rack my brain. What do people tell their bosses in private? What's going on? He finally asks. I can taste the words I should say, the ones that were running through my head all morning. I found a picture of my husband. But it's too late for them now, even if I could force them out of my mouth. I look at the maps that cover the walls, big ones of Russia, political maps, road maps, topography maps. My gaze settles on the largest one, the contours of the country. I zero in on the sliver of land between Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Volgograd. There's a family issue, I say. I can just barely make out the letters on the map. I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't have a plan. He exhales softly. Oh, Vivian. When I look over, his eyes are full of concern, sympathy. I understand. It takes a moment for what he's saying to register, and when it does, guilt washes over me. I look behind him to the framed pictures on his desk, all of the same woman, a yellowed picture of her in a white lace dress, a candid shot of her opening a present, puffy sweater, puffy hair, absolute delight on her face. A more recent one, she and Peter together, mountains in the background, both looking completely comfortable, at ease, happy. I swallow and look back at Peter. How is she? How's Catherine? He looks away. Catherine has breast cancer, stage 3, diagnosed last year. I still remember the day he told us all. A team meeting in the conference room. Stunned silence as we watched Peter, stoic Peter, break down and cry. She got into a clinical trial soon after. Peter's never said much about it, but it seemed like she was fighting it. Then a couple of weeks ago, he missed some work, completely out of character for him, and when he finally came back, pale and tired, he told us she was no longer in the trial. No tears this time, but the same silence. We knew what it meant. The treatment wasn't working. She was at the end of the road. It was only a matter of time. She's a fighter, he answers. But the look in his eyes says it's a battle she can't win. His jaw clenches tight. And so's your little boy. I have a moment of confusion and then a flash of realization. He knows Caleb had a cardiologist appointment yesterday. He's assuming there's been a setback. I should correct him, but I don't. I look down at my lap and nod, a sick feeling in my stomach. If there's anything I can do, he says. Thanks. An awkward pause, and then he speaks. Go home, why don't you? Deal with this. I look up. I can't. I don't have the leave. How many years did you spend working hours you didn't claim? I give him a half smile. Many. Take the rest of the day. I'm about to refuse, and then I hesitate. What am I worried about? Losing my job because of this? Failing my next polygraph over this? I feel some of the tension draining away from my body. This is what I need. Get away from here, clear my head, try to figure out what to do next. Thanks, Peter. I'll pray for you, he says softly as I'm standing to leave. He gives me a long look. For strength. I walk back to my desk. Helen and Raph have their chairs rolled into the aisle near my cubicle, and they're deep in conversation. There's no way I could do anything about the file now, not without them seeing. Tomorrow. I can deal with it tomorrow. I hesitate a moment, then log off the computer and gather my bag and jacket. I linger, watching the screen, waiting for it to go black. And as I do, my gaze drifts to the corner of my desk, the picture of Matt and me on our wedding day. And I'm overcome with a strange sensation, a feeling that we dodged a bullet, but that somehow, inexplicably, I'm bleeding. 6 months after we met, I was finally going to see where Matt came from, meet his parents, see the house where he grew up, his high school, meet his childhood friends. I'd accumulated a week's worth of leave. Matt booked the tickets, or said he did anyway. I was so excited to be going, I could barely contain myself. He'd just met my parents. We'd all spent Christmas together in Charlottesville, and it went better than I could have hoped. My parents loved him. And I loved him even more, seeing him with them. I knew without a doubt I wanted to marry him. Engagement, though, still seemed like something far in the future. I hadn't even met his parents, and there was no way I'd get engaged to someone without meeting his parents. It just didn't seem right. I'd told him that, too. At least, I thought I had. We were at the airport, a frigid day in January. I wore the outfit I'd spent hours agonizing over, pants and a cardigan, cute but conservative, picked to make a good impression on my hopefully future in-laws. We were in the winding security line, black rolling suitcases in tow. Matt was quiet. He looked nervous, and that made me nervous, because the last thing I wanted was him to be worried about me meeting his parents, to be having second thoughts about us. When we neared the front of the line, it occurred to me that he still had my boarding pass, the one he'd printed off before we left. "Oh," I said, "can I have my boarding pass?" He handed me a folded piece of paper, his eyes never leaving mine, his face studiously blank. His look made me even more unsettled. "Thanks," I said. I finally broke his gaze, looked down at the pass to make sure he'd handed me mine and not his, since he did it without looking. I saw my name, Vivian Gray, and the three letters, large and bold, that weren't supposed to be there. H-N-L. Not the airport code for Seattle, that much I knew. I stared at the letters, trying to place them, trying to make sense of them. "Honolulu," Matt said, and I felt his arms encircle my waist. "What?" I spun around to face him. He was grinning. "Well, Maui, actually. We have a connecting flight when we get there." "Maui?" He gave me a gentle nudge forward. I blinked, looked, and it was my turn at security. The TSA agent was giving me an annoyed look. I handed over the boarding pass and dug out my driver's license, fumbling, cheeks hot, utterly confused. He stamped the pass, and I walked through, over to the conveyor belt, started taking off my shoes. Matt came up behind me and lifted my suitcase onto the belt, then his. Then I felt his arms around me again, his cheek coming to rest near mine. "What do you think?" he said, his breath hot against my ear, and I could hear the smile in his voice. What did I think? That I wanted to go to Seattle. I wanted to meet his parents, see where he came from. "But your family..." I walked through the metal detector. He did the same, and we stood beside each other again as my bag rolled to the end of the belt. "I couldn't let you use all your leave on Seattle," he said. What was I supposed to say? That I would have preferred Seattle? How ungrateful would that be? He just bought me a trip to Maui. Maui. And given up time with his family. At the same time, didn't he know how important it was to me to meet his family? And that now we'd have to put off Seattle for months longer until I'd built up more leave? He lifted our luggage down to the floor. "I repacked your suitcase," he said. He pulled up the handle and spun it around toward me. "It's all warm-weather clothes now, lots of swimsuits." He was smiling. Then he pulled me close until my hips were against his. "Of course, I'm hoping we'll be spending more time without them." His eyes were dancing. "I don't know what to say," I finally said, my mind screaming, "Is it too late to change our tickets?" The smile faded from his face and his arms dropped to his side. "Oh," he said. Just that one syllable, and then I was overcome with guilt. Look at what he'd just done for me. "It's just that I was really looking forward to meeting your parents." He looked absolutely crestfallen. "I'm sorry, I really am. I just thought... He gave his head a quick shake. "Let's go. Let's see if we can change the tickets." I grabbed his hand. "Wait." I didn't even know why I stopped him, what I was going to say. I just knew I hated the look on his face, hated the way I just made him feel. "No, you're right. I shouldn't have done this. It's just that I wanted everything to be perfect when I asked you." He stopped abruptly, and color rose to his cheeks. "Asked you to marry me." I could almost hear the words. I was certain that's what was coming next. I felt like my heart stopped. I stared at him, the look of panic on his face, cheeks redder than I'd ever seen them. Oh my God, he was going to ask me to marry him. We were going to Hawaii because he'd planned the perfect proposal. A beach. An exotic location. There's nothing I would have wanted more. And now I'd gone and ruined it. "Ask me," I said. The words came out of my mouth before I could think them through. But once they were out, they made sense. The trip would have been painfully awkward after this. The only way to salvage the trip was to change the whole tenor of it. Get rid of the elephant in the room. "What?" he breathed. "Ask me," I said with more confidence. "Here?" He looked incredulous. I was looking at the man I was going to marry, the one I loved with all my heart. What did it matter where we got engaged? I nodded. The embarrassment left his face was replaced with a half-smile, a look of wonderment, of excitement. And I knew I'd made the right decision. This was salvageable after all. He grabbed my other hand. "Vivian, I love you more than anything in the world. You make me happier than I ever thought possible, happier than I deserve." Tears sprung to my eyes. This was my future, the man I was going to spend the rest of my life with. "I want nothing more than to spend my life with you." Then he dropped one of my hands, reached into his pocket, pulled out a ring. Just a ring, no box. He must have placed it in the tray at the metal detector with his wallet and keys, and I didn't even notice. He knelt down on one knee and held it out, his face so hopeful, so vulnerable. "Will you marry me?" "Of course," I whispered. And I saw the relief and happiness etched on his face as he slid it onto my finger. Applause erupted around us from a crowd I didn't know had gathered. I laughed, giddy, hugged Matt, kissed him, right there in the middle of the airport. Looked at the ring on my finger, the diamond sparkling under fluorescent lights, and didn't care a bit in that moment that I hadn't caught even a glimpse of his past. Because the future was all that mattered. I pull into the garage, my mind a jumbled mess. I did the right thing, didn't I? I mean, it was impulsive. And I need to do more tomorrow to clean it up, to get rid of the file permanently. But I was right to make this all disappear, to keep our lives intact. Only, I have the overwhelming sense that I should have thought things through before I acted, that I need to think through the consequences now, at least. My mind is balking, though. It's like I know I can't handle what I'll learn. I walk inside, and I see Matt through the kitchen doorway. He's looking in my direction, holding a dish towel, drying his hands. He looks calm, remarkably calm, not like someone who thinks I just turned him in. Everything here looks normal. I can hear the TV in the family room, the show about the stuffed animals that come to life. "You're home early," he says. "But then we'd talked about keeping everything normal, hadn't we, for my protection?" He's probably assuming someone's listening in right now, maybe even watching. I take off my jacket, hang it on the hook near the door. I drop my bag to the floor beside it. Then I take a step closer to him. "I couldn't do it," I say softly. The dish towel goes still. It takes him a moment to speak. "What do you mean?" "I couldn't do it. I couldn't turn you in." He folds the towel and sets it down on the counter. "Viv, we've been through this. You have to." I shake my head. "I don't. I got rid of it." He's staring at me with an intensity that sends a chill through me. "Got rid of what?" "The thing that connects you to all of this."
"What did you do?"
"I made it all disappear." Panic's creeping into my voice. "I didn't, though. Not yet, anyway. Can I make it disappear?" His eyes are burning. "What did you do, Viv?" "What did I do? Oh, God." He runs a hand through his hair, then covers his mouth. "You were supposed to turn me in," he says quietly. "I couldn't," I say in an equally hushed tone. And that's the truth, isn't it? I knew deep down it was the right thing to do, the only thing to do. But when it came time to actually do it, to set a ball rolling that I'd never be able to stop, that would crush us all, I couldn't do it. He shakes his head. "Things like this, they don't just disappear." He takes a step closer to me. "It's going to come out eventually. They'll figure out what you did." I feel like someone's grabbed hold of my heart. They can't find out. No one can ever find out. "I needed you there for the kids," he says. "I did this for the kids," I shoot back. How dare he act like I wasn't thinking about the kids? Our family was the only thing on my mind. "And now what? What happens to the kids when we're both convicted of spying for Russia?" I feel like all the air has left my lungs. I reach out a hand to the wall, steady myself. "Spying for Russia, espionage. Is that what I've done? What would happen to the kids? Would they be sent to Russia? A country they don't know, a language they don't know, all their dreams destroyed?" The terror is all-consuming now, but I'm angry, furious at him at the same time. And it's this part of me that finds a voice. "If I turned you in, what would happen to the kids? What would happen to us?"
"It's better than..."
I take a step closer. "We'd lose your salary. I'd get fired, and we'd lose mine, too. We'd lose our health insurance, our home." He looks stricken, the color draining from his face. And I like it. I like seeing him this way, feeling as desperate, as hopeless as I do. They'd forever be known as the kids of a Russian spy. What would that do to them? He runs his hand through his hair again. He looks so unsure, so unlike the Matt I know, the one who's unflappable, who's unfailingly calm and collected. "Don't you dare blame me for this," I add. I sound combative, am combative, but deep down, I'm terrified. His words are ringing in my head. "I needed you there for the kids." Needed. Past tense.
I didn't want to take away their father, but what if I've done something much worse?
Intentionally covering up evidence, conspiracy, espionage, it would all be on the table.
What if I go to jail for this?
You're right, he says. I blink, focus on him. He's nodding. A look of confidence has returned to his face, determination, like he knows what to do.
This is my fault. I need to fix it.
It's exactly what I need to hear.
Yes, fix it. Get us out of this.
I can feel some of the tension start to drain from my shoulders. He's thrown out a lifeline just when drowning feels inevitable, and I'm already reaching for it, already holding on.
He lowers his voice, leans forward until his face is right in front of mine.
But in order to do that, I need you to tell me everything. Exactly what you found, and exactly how you made it disappear.
Chapter 7. I stare at him. He's asking me to share classified information, to become the kind of person I've spent my career hunting down.
He knows that.
He's manipulating you, a voice in my head warns.
But he doesn't look like he's manipulating me. He looks so sincere, so desperate.
He's trying to find a way to get us out of this, something I don't know how to do right now.
And it makes sense, really. I have to tell him what I know. How else can he do anything about it?
I've already crossed lines I never should have, telling him I discovered his identity, erasing the file.
But this?
Telling him exactly what I found, exactly what I did?
I'd be disclosing information about Athena, one of the agency's most sensitive programs, information I'd sworn to protect.
I swallow, my throat so tight I almost can't.
I need to think. I need to process whether this actually makes sense.
I brush past him, wordless, into the family room where Ella's sitting, tangled in a blanket, watching TV. I paste a smile on my face.
How are you, sweetie?
She looks up and gives me a grin, one that morphs quickly into a faux sick look.
Sick, Mommy.
Last week, I would have struggled not to laugh at her act. Now, it chills me. Because it's a lie, isn't it? Something her father does so well.
I keep the smile pasted on my face.
I'm sorry you're not feeling well, I say. I watch her a moment longer, watch her attention turn back to the TV screen. I'm trying to marshal my thoughts into some semblance of order. Then I raise my head to meet Matt's eyes, speak to her even as I look at him.
Daddy and I are going to sit out front and talk.
Okay, she murmurs, her attention on her show. I walk out the front door, leaving it open. Matt follows, closes the door behind us. The cold air hits me like a slap. I should have grabbed my coat. I sit on the top of our front stoop and wrap my arms around my chest, huddle into a ball.
Do you want a jacket? Matt asks.
No.
He sits down beside me. So close we're touching.
I can feel his warmth, the pressure of his knee against mine.
He's looking straight ahead.
I know it's a lot to ask, but I need to know more if I'm going to fix this.
Manipulation?
Is it, though? For whatever reason, our engagement day floats through my mind. That moment in the airport, the two of us, the crowd around us dispersing, smiles on their faces. One on my own face as well, looking down at that ring, seeing it catch the light, so new, so clean, so perfect. And then the realization. I got engaged without meeting his parents. Something that was so important to me, I'd told him that, hadn't I? I could feel the smile fading from my lips, felt his arm around my shoulders, guiding me away, deeper into the airport, toward our gate. We were engaged. We were headed for Hawaii, just like he wanted. But at the same time, he'd planned a perfect proposal for me. In Hawaii. And planned to surprise me with it. I looked up at him, saw the openness on his face, the happiness and excitement, and I smiled at him. I was being ridiculous, so he made one mistake. I wasn't even completely sure I'd mentioned it, that I wanted to meet his parents before we got engaged. Maybe I hadn't. But the misgivings never quite went away. Through all the days on the beach, the hikes to waterfalls, the candlelit dinners, the thought was lodged in the back of my head. I'd gotten engaged in an airport, in front of a crowd of strangers, without ever having met his parents. That's not what I'd wanted, at all. But you urged him to ask you right then, right there, I told myself. And then it was our last morning there. We were out on the little balcony, sitting there with our mugs of coffee, watching the swaying palms, feeling the warm breeze. "I know you wanted to meet my parents first," he said out of the blue. I looked over in surprise. So I had said it. He had known. But I'm me, Viv, regardless of who my parents are. He looked at me with such intensity I was taken aback. The past is the past. He's ashamed of his parents, I realized. He's worried about what I'll think of them, what I'll think of him after I meet them. I looked down at the ring on my finger. But still, what about what I wanted? "But what I did was wrong," he said. I looked back up at him, saw the sincerity in his eyes. The regret, so much regret. "I'm sorry." I wanted the misgivings to dissipate. I really did. He'd made a mistake. He admitted it, apologized. But I could never quite get over it. That he knew I wanted to meet his parents first, went ahead and proposed anyway. It felt like manipulation. But now, as I stare at the ring, the diamond that doesn't sparkle nearly as much anymore on a hand that's so much older, it doesn't. It feels honest. If those weren't his real parents, wasn't it more honest that I didn't meet them before we got engaged? They might have helped shape my opinion of him, my feelings toward him. Wouldn't that, in fact, have been the manipulation? I turn toward him and scoot away, just enough so that I can face him comfortably, so that I can read his expression. It looks honest, open, the same look he had when he asked me to marry him, the same one I saw on our wedding day all those years ago. I picture us before the priest, the old stone church in Charlottesville, the look on his face when he said his vows. That kind of sincerity can't be faked, can it? I swallow past the tightness in my throat. I don't know. The truth is, I have no idea whether to believe him. But I need a hand. I need help. I've dug myself into a hole, and he's offered to help me climb out. His question won't stop running through my head. What happens to the kids when we're both convicted of spying for Russia? I can't let that happen. I have to believe him. "We have access to Yuri's computer," I say. And the words are harder to get out than I expected. With every syllable, I feel like I'm committing a crime. I am committing a crime. I'm disclosing classified information, violating the Espionage Act. Barely anyone in the agency even knows about Athena's capabilities. It's so restricted. People go to jail for sharing information like this. I was digging around, found a folder with five pictures. I glance over at him. Yours was one of them. He's staring straight ahead, nods ever so slightly. Just my picture? Anything else about me? I shake my head. Haven't come across anything else. Encrypted? No. He sits quietly for a moment, then turns to face me.
Tell me what you did.
I erased it.
How?
You know, clicked delete. Deleted it.
Then what?
Then deleted it from the recycle bin.
And?
His voice has an edge. I swallow. Nothing else yet. I know I need to do more, overwrite the hard drive or whatever, but there were people nearby and I couldn't. I look away, out to the street. I hear an engine, a vehicle approaching. I watch the street, see it come into view. An orange van. That house cleaning service that so many of the neighbors use. It pulls to a stop in front of the Parker's house. I watch as three women in orange vests get out of the van and gather cleaning supplies from the rear. When they're inside and the door closes behind them, quiet descends on the street once again.
They have a record of you deleting it, Matt says. There's no way they don't record user activity.
I watch my breath crystallize in the air, little clouds. I know that already, don't I? Didn't I click past screens warning me my actions are recorded? What was I thinking?
I wasn't. That's the problem. I just wanted it all to go away.
I look over at Matt. He's staring straight ahead, his brows knitted together, a look of deep concentration on his face. The silence around us is heavy.
Okay, he finally says.
He places a hand on my knee, gives it a squeeze. He turns to face me, the creases in his forehead pronounced, his eyes clouded with worry.
I'll get you out of this.
He stands, walks back inside. I stay seated, shivering, his words reverberating in my skull.
I'll get you out of this.
You. Why didn't he say us? I'm still on the front stoop a few minutes later when Matt returns, car keys in hand. He pauses above me.
I'll be back in a bit, he says.
What are you going to do?
Don't worry about it.
He could be leaving, getting on a plane back to Russia, leaving me to deal with the fallout. But he wouldn't do that, would he? But what is he doing? And why didn't he do it to begin with? I deserve to know. He starts walking past me toward his car parked in the driveway. The less you know, Viv, the better. I get to my feet. What's that supposed to mean? He stops, turns to face me, speaks quietly.
Polygraph. Trial. It's just better if you don't know details.
I stare at him and he stares back. The look on his face is troubled, angry even, and that makes me furious. Why are you angry with me right now? He raises his hands, his car keys clanging together.
Because if you just listened to me, we wouldn't be in this mess.
We glare at each other, the silence almost suffocating. Then he shakes his head, like I'm a disappointment. I watch him go without another word. The emotions inside me are roiling, jumbled, making no sense at all. We celebrated our first anniversary in the Bahamas. 5 days of lying in the sun with an endless supply of tropical drinks, the occasional dip in the ocean to cool off, where we'd soon be wrapped around each other, finding lips that tasted like rum and sea salt. Our last night there, we were at a beach bar, a little place in the sand with a thatched roof and string lights and fruity drinks. We sat on weathered bar stools, close enough that our legs were touching, that his hand could rest on my thigh, just a little too high. I remember listening to the crash of the waves, breathing in the salt air, feeling warm all over. So, I said, running a finger over the little umbrella in my drink, tossing over the question that had been on my mind all night, the one that had been slowly forming in my head for weeks, months. I tried to come up with the best way to lead up to it, and when I couldn't, I just blurted it out. When should we have a baby? He practically sputtered into his drink, looked up at me, eyes wide, full of love, openness, excitement. Then something shifted, and they became more guarded. He looked away. "Kids are a big step," he said. And even through my rum-induced haze, I was confused. He loved kids. We'd always planned to have some, two probably, maybe three. "We've been married a year," I said.
"We're still young."
I looked down at my drink, something pink, and stirred around the half-melted ice cubes with my straw. That wasn't the response I'd expected, not at all. "What's going on?"
"I just think there's no rush, you know. Maybe we wait a few years, focus on our careers."
"Our careers? Since when did he want us to focus on our careers?"
"Yeah." He was avoiding my eyes. "I mean, take yours."
He lowered his voice, leaned in closer, and this time he looked at me intently.
"Africa, is that really the part of the world you want to focus on?"
I looked away. I'd been perfectly happy with the African CI account. There was enough to keep me busy, to keep my days interesting. I felt like I was making a difference, albeit in a small way. And that's all I really wanted. Africa wasn't as high profile as some of the other accounts, but that was fine with me.
"Sure.
I mean, wouldn't it be more interesting to work something like Russia?" I took a long sip of my drink through the straw. "Sure, it'd be more interesting. More stress, too. Longer hours, for sure. And there were so many people working the account. How much impact would one person really have?"
"I guess. And maybe better for your career, for promotions and all that?"
When had he ever cared about promotions? And why did he think I did? If money was my goal, I wouldn't have chosen a career in government. The warm feeling inside me was starting to chill around the edges.
"I mean, it's up to you, of course, sweetheart. It's your job and all." He shrugged. "I just think you'd be happier if you were doing something more important, you know?"
The words stung. It was the first time I'd ever felt like my job wasn't good enough for Matt, that I wasn't good enough. His expression softened, and he placed a hand over mine, gave me an earnest look, apologetic, like he knew he'd hurt my feelings.
"It's just, well, that's what the best analysts focus on, right? Russia?"
Where was this coming from? I was so confused.
"Sure, it was a competitive account, the kind a lot of people wanted. But there was something to be said for working a low-profile account, too. Making sure nothing fell through the cracks, nothing was overlooked. Being able to see the impact I was making."
"You're the kind of person who always wants to be the best. That's what I love about you."
That's what he loved about me? The compliment felt like a slap.
"And it'd probably be harder to make that kind of move after we have kids," he went on. "So maybe you should get to a place you want to be, and then we should think about kids."
He stirred his drink with his straw as he said it, still avoiding my eyes.
I drained the remnants of my drink. The sweetness gone, now nothing but bitterness.
"Okay," I said, as a chill ran through me.
As soon as the taillights of Matt's car disappear around the corner, I walk back into the house. I check on Ella, who's still in front of the TV, then head to the storage area behind the stairs. I need to see what's on that laptop. It's a small space, crowded with stacks of blue plastic bins. I pull the chain to turn on the light and look down at the floor, the narrow section that's bare. Nothing seems out of the ordinary. I get down on my hands and knees, feel around, finally come across a floorboard that's raised slightly on one side. I run my hand over it, try to lift it. To no avail. I glance around the room and spot a screwdriver on top of one of the plastic bins. I use it to pry up the floorboard, then peer inside. Something's catching the light. I reach in and pull out a small silver laptop. I sit cross-legged and open the laptop, turn it on. It starts quickly, and I see a black screen with a single white bar, a blinking cursor. There's no text, but it's password protected. That much is clear. I try Matt's usual passwords, the ones he uses for everything, various compilations of our kids' names and birth dates. Then I try the password we use for our joint accounts. Nothing works, but why would it? A different set of words runs through my head. Alexander Linkov, Mikhail and Natalia, Volgograd. I have no way of guessing what might have been on his mind when he came up with a password, if he's even the one who came up with it. This is futile. Frustrated, I close the laptop and return the room to the way I found it. Then I head back to the family room to check on Ella. "You doing okay, sweetie?" I ask. "Yeah," she murmurs, doesn't take her eyes off the TV. I linger for a moment, then walk upstairs to the master bedroom, pause in the doorway. I go over to Matt's nightstand first, pull open the drawer, dig around. Crumpled receipts, spare change, some pictures Ella drew for him. Nothing remotely suspicious. I look under the bed, pull out a plastic container. It's full of his summer clothes, swimsuits, shorts, T-shirts. I close it and slide it back underneath. I open the top drawer of his dresser, move around the stack of boxers, the pile of socks, looking for anything that doesn't belong. Then I do the same with the next drawer, and the one after that. Nothing. I head into the closet, run a hand over the clothes hanging on his rack, polos, button-downs, pants. I'm not even sure what I'm trying to find. Something that proves he's not the person I think he is. Or the absence of it. Would that be enough to prove that he is? There's an old duffel bag on the shelf above. I reach for it and pull it down to the carpet. I unzip it, rifle through. A collection of ties, he hasn't used those in years, and some old baseball caps. I check each zippered pocket. Empty. I put the bag back on the shelf and pull down a stack of shoeboxes, kneel down on the carpet with them. The first is full of old bills, the second, receipts, the third, his dress shoes, shiny and black. I sit back on my heels, the open box in my lap. What am I doing? How has my life come to this? I'm about to replace the lid of the box when something catches my eye. Something black tucked into one of the shoes. I know what it is even before my fingers curl around it. It's a gun. I pull it out by the grip and look at it. The black metal slide, the wide trigger. A Glock. I move the slide, see brass inside. It's loaded. Matt has a loaded gun in our closet. I hear Ella downstairs calling for me, hands shaking. I place the pistol back in the shoe, close the lid, stack the boxes back on the shelf. Give them one last look, then turn off the light and head downstairs. Matt comes home 3 hours later, bustles in, removes his jacket, gives me a smile, apologetic and embarrassed. Then he comes over and wraps his arms around me. "I'm sorry," he says into my hair. He's still cold from the air outside, cold hands, cold cheeks. A shiver runs through me. "I shouldn't have said all that. It's not fair for me to be upset with you. This is my fault." I pull back and look at him. He looks like a stranger, feels like a stranger. All I can picture is that gun in our closet. Did you do what you needed to do?
He drops his hands, turns away, but not before I see the expression on his face. Tense.
Yeah. So, are we okay?
In my mind, I see the gun again. It's been hours now, and I still don't know what to make of it. Is it proof that he's not who I think he is, that he's dangerous? Or is it a way to protect us, his family, from the people who really are dangerous?
He's very still, his back to me.
I see his shoulders rise and fall, like he's taken a deep breath and exhaled.
I hope so.
I get to my desk the next morning and see the little red flashing light on my phone. Voicemail. I flip through the call history. 3 calls from Omar, 2 yesterday and 1 this morning. I close my eyes. I knew this would come, didn't I? Or should have, at least, if I'd thought it through. I pick up the phone, dial his number. I need to get this over with.
Vivian,
he says when he answers. Omar, sorry I missed your calls. I left early yesterday. Just got in this morning.
No worries.
There's a pause. Look, about Yuri's computer. My nails are digging into my palm. It's not looking very promising. I'm afraid there's nothing there. I hate this, lying to him. I picture the two of us, all those years ago, commiserating over the Bureau's rejection of his op plan. And all the time since, at O'Neill's, and our offices, and even our homes, sharing our frustrations about our inability to find anything worthwhile. Our conviction that the sleepers are a genuine threat and we're powerless to stop it. A friendship cemented over a mutual feeling of futility. And now I finally have something and I have no choice but to lie to him about it. He's silent on the other end of the phone. I close my eyes, like somehow it'll make the lies easier. Obviously, we need to wait for translation and exploitation, but so far, I haven't found anything of interest. My voice sounds surprisingly confident. Another pause.
Nothing?
My nails dig in even harder. There's always the chance there's something embedded in the files, steganography or something like that. But so far, nothing.
You always find something.
Now it's my turn to pause. Disappointment, I understand. But there is something more. This is unsettling.
Yeah. With the other 4, you found something with each of them, enough to warrant expedited translation.
I know,
but with this one, you didn't.
It's a statement. Not a question. And there's an unmistakable tone of skepticism in his voice. My heart's racing now.
Well, I say, and fight to keep the tremor out of my voice. Haven't come across anything yet.
Hmm, he says.
That's not what Peter said.
I feel like I've been punched in the gut, the wind knocked out of me. It's got to be the pictures. He found the pictures. Whatever Matt did, it wasn't enough. And then suddenly I'm aware of someone behind me. I turn and it's Peter, standing silent, watching me, listening.
I didn't know he'd found anything, I say into the phone, my eyes on Peter the whole time, letting him hear what I'm saying.
My mouth is very dry. Peter nods. The expression on his face